Our goal is to promote a culture of peace by teaching the truth and providing a community where people can discover the hidden knowledge about the past and current social issues and tragedies that we seem to ignore. But before we begin, it is my honor to welcome you, our listeners, and our esteemed guests today for our program. I am your co-host, Jacqueline Kalaga, along with Basil, and we are broadcasting from New York. So we are sending peace and blessings to you wherever you are right now, and we ask you to relax and listen to what is being addressed today, and we would really like to make this an interesting and informative discussion. So today we want to be discussing global child trafficking, this hidden human tragedy of our time. You know, it's true that many countries and international organizations have gone to the extent to try to create an impact where there has been so much damage done, not just by traffickers themselves, but when we're looking at those that are being trafficked, particularly today we are focusing on children who are being trafficked. And this is still an epidemic in our 21st century, and it has been remaining since, and it still becomes an issue that we are continually dealing with, and it becomes an issue not just when we look at, you know, violent extremists, terrorists. We're also seeing this in the political campaigns. And many voices have been silenced, and many action plans to stop this epidemic have not yet been implemented, or even programs that have been implemented are finding difficulties trying to create plausible solutions. So the more time that we continue to talk about this issue without really creating practical solutions, more and more young children and adults are finding themselves victims in order to satisfy greed by these traffickers. And so I wanted to introduce today not just a friend of mine, but also our esteemed guest, Giselle Rodriguez, who's the state coordinator for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking. And we'll definitely be speaking with her about her experience working in the field and some hopes that she has for the future. But to get started, let's turn to our other co-host today, Ryan, who is going to inform us today on some many new interesting news topics that are going on. Ryan?
Yes, thank you, Jacqueline. Peace and blessings. In Memphis, Tennessee, after a 29-member state commission has spent hours discussing and revising for text for a new historical marker, and as to whether the title should refer to it as the 1866 Memphis Massacre, as proposed as the NAACP's Memphis branch, or the Memphis Race Riot of 1866, which the commission approved in October. The proposed marker will include both Memphis Race Riot of 1866 and the Memphis Massacre as its titles. The text would also describe the historical events as follows. On May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1866, an estimated 200 to 300 white people, the great majority of whom were Irish immigrants, including the many policemen, attacked recently freed black people. At least black riders.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners and our guests from the United States and around the world. And we want to apologize for the technical glitches that we experienced on this show. And I want to bring news expert, Ryan Jacob Burke, so he can continue with the news. Ryan?
Yes, Basil. Can you hear me good?
Yes.
Okay. Recently, in regards to India, Amnesty rebuked Indian authorities for failing to prevent many incidents of religious violence and sometimes contributing to tensions through polarizing speeches and pervasive caste-based discrimination and violence. A report highlighting that women in India were reluctant to report incidents of violence mentions, although nearly 322,000 crimes against women, including over 3,700 cases of rape, were reported in 2014. Stigma and discrimination by police officials and authorities in India continue to deter women from reporting sexual violence, and most states still lack standard operating procedures for the police to address violence against women. It is also highlighted restrictive foreign funding laws being used to repress NGOs critical of the government. Moreover, the country of Burundi, which has endured a 13-year civil war that ended in 2006, has been facing economic collapse. Amid pervasive poverty, hunger, and corruption, the majority of the population suffers from chronic malnutrition. Although 90% of the population are farmers, Burundi can barely produce enough food to sustain itself. Government corruption has affected the development of private sectors and foreign investment, and the country depends on foreign aid to fund about 50% of its national budget. The insecurity also affects projects, as international donors and aid agencies have evacuated many of their experts from the country. Burundi's budget deficit will only increase as other donors, including the former colonial power Belgium, suspends more aid. Burundi is also facing a range of security and governance issues that threaten its stability. The economy is struggling due to inflation, political instability, and a large-scale refugees movement. An estimated 230,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries since April of 2015, many to Rwanda. Yet despite having much in common, Burundi and Rwanda have not had the best of relationships. The two countries share similar cultures, ethnic divides, and economic challenges. They also have a colonial heritage of being governed as one territory by the Belgian colonialists. Both have gone through complicated violent conflicts related to the ethnic divisions and are still fragile nations. For more news and updated information regarding these and other topics, please visit icermediation.org.
Thank you, Ryan, for letting us know about what's going on around the world. That's actually very informative, telling us about what's going on in Burundi and Rwanda and the ethnic problems, the ethnic conflicts and violence are taking place around the world. I want to thank you for that, and also I want to apologize to our listeners and our esteemed guest for today's show. With respect to our technical issues, we hope all this will be fixed within a short while. We want to return back to our co-host, Jacqueline. Jacqueline?
Yes, thank you. You know, this is definitely a serious topic that many people have been talking about for a very long time. Trafficking, again, has become a very big hot topic. And when we look at the international agencies as well as local and national agencies, there are definitely numbers and statistics that have been displayed throughout different websites and advertisements and the sort. And you know, obviously, we'll be speaking with Giselle today, who will help us understand how to look at these statistics and really understand that are based off of certain data measures and very, you know, divided, you know, areas where it is not necessarily an accurate number, but rather a guesstimation to give people an understanding of how bad the problem really can be. And so we are delighted and thrilled to be able to have Giselle Rodriguez, the State Outreach Coordinator for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking and the founder of the Tampa Bay Rescue and Restore Coalition. So, Giselle, we want to say thank you so much for joining us today. Giselle, are you able to hear us?
I'm sorry?
I just wanted to welcome you to the show today. I just wanted to make sure that you were able to hear us. Thank you so much.
Yes, I can definitely hear you. Thank you for the invitation.
Wonderful. So, you know, to our listeners, as we are speaking with Giselle today, you're going to have an opportunity to bring your voice to the table, to our discussion, and make your views known to the world. In order to do so, please call our number, 323-642-1263. Again, to ask for questions or to contribute to the discussion, please call 323-642-1263. And remember, if you are outside of the United States, you must dial 1 before the number. So, Giselle, before we get started with some of the questions that we have today, I was hoping you could tell our listeners a little bit about what the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking is, how they're involved in the community, and a little bit about the Tampa Bay Rescue and Restore Coalition.
Absolutely. The Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking was founded by Anna Rodriguez in May of 2004. We were actually the very first anti-human trafficking organization to address the issue of human trafficking within the state of Florida. Anna's actually been working on the issue since 1999 when she came across a victim of labor trafficking and domestic servitude back in January of 1999 while working on what appeared to be a domestic violence incident. This was a 19-year-old woman that was brought to the United States from Guatemala against her will and was forced to work in the agricultural industry as well as doing domestic work. She was also sexually assaulted by the perpetrator. And that's basically how the report came in, due to the fact that the wife walked in on her husband sexually assaulting the 19-year-old. Now, this case was, from a legal perspective, was interesting because it was prosecuted using various different laws. He was charged with various crimes, one of them being the crime of slavery. So that case was actually instrumental in assisting with the passage of the federal law that we have here in the United States called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. So since then, Anna's been working on assisting with providing services to victims that have been found within the state of Florida and has also assisted with training not just officials within the state of Florida, but throughout various states in the U.S. And she's also been to 34 different countries to help with training of law enforcement officials, prosecutors, judges, consular officials, and social service providers. So this is something that we still continue to do to this day. We are still out there training first-line responders, social service providers, and community advocates. And, of course, we also raise awareness to our youth who definitely need to know more about what's happening around them and how they can make a difference in the fight against human trafficking, not just here but globally as well. And as far as international work, Anna and myself have actually still been able to go into other countries to, again, assist with training. And a lot of this is all through the Anti-Trafficking Persons Unit through the Organization of American States.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you guys are doing a whole lot of work and wonderful work, and it's difficult work. You know, I imagine it couldn't be something so simple to deal with, especially with so many different entities. So when we begin to have this discussion, and, you know, I can sit here and ask you all the basic information about what human trafficking is, what it looks like, and all of these things, but I think you know, many media outlets, and there are so many trainings and so many programs that go into the basics and one-on-one about what human trafficking is. And to be fair, and I guess you can, you know, piggyback on that, but when we look at trafficking, we're essentially looking at enslaving a human being to do either labor, physical labor, or some sort of sexual, you know, sexual work in order to have another individual profit from that in some entity. And with that comes violent abuses, psychological, mental, physical, emotional, all these different things. Would you, pretty much in a nutshell, if we're looking at this, since it's such a hot topic, I guess, Jen, you know, to encompass that, that's how basically I can kind of describe that for our viewers today.
Absolutely. I mean, you're spot on. It's, you know, when we talk about human trafficking, we're basically talking about slavery. One of the things that, you know, we are seeing is the fact that a lot of things that we have read about that occurred in our history are still happening today. And unfortunately, that's a tough pill for people to swallow, you know, to come to terms with the fact that slavery is still occurring in this day and age is not something that a lot of people are fully embracing. But as you mentioned, you know, many of the victims are forced into some type of cheap labor or forced labor operation, or some of them are forced into the commercial sex industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And, you know, to even just go a little bit further, I think oftentimes, and I speak very much on this because, you know, I've worked with you, I've worked with other agencies in this field, so I think, you know, I have a little information that I'd like to share as well. But, you know, when we look at this idea of what trafficking is, I think oftentimes, not just the media, but people who are learning and understanding about what trafficking is and what it looks like, people begin to have this idea of what people in that work in the field that we do, what they call the perfect victim. You know, that you know, young girl who, you know, was, you know, she looks scared and alone, and when you go to help her, she's ready and willing to take on your help, and then there's a happily ever after story at the end. And, you know, maybe you can kind of attest to some of this, but that's not always the case when we look at all forms of trafficking. It doesn't look the way that people want it to necessarily look.
Absolutely. You know, it's somewhat of a catch-22 because we are very happy with the fact that more and more people are addressing the issue of human trafficking. It's great to see all these documentaries. It's wonderful to see different news channels addressing the issue. But one of the things that many people may not realize is that a lot of what's being portrayed in the media or is being shared amongst various groups isn't the full picture. And even that, you know, some of the things that are being shared sometimes tend to be exaggerated or embellished. We're starting to see a lot of different reports that are coming out, basically debunking a lot of statistics that were being used within the anti-sex trafficking movement. So we're definitely seeing that, again, a lot of the information that is out there, unfortunately, isn't necessarily the truth. When it comes to sex trafficking, most people immediately feel that it's a young woman being exploited by a male. But needless to say, we've seen situations in where some of the girls may not actually be under the control of a trafficker. Some of them are basically on the streets and engaging in commercial sex acts in order to survive. But we don't necessarily address that because, again, we always want to portray this sleazy person in charge or coercing this young girl into these commercial sex acts. So more needs to be done to address the children that unfortunately are either homeless or run away from home and are, again, engaging in these commercial sex acts in order to obtain those things that they need to survive, their necessities. We also see situations in where the victims are males. Here in the Tampa area, our FBI actually just finished indicting a female trafficker who is prostituting males out. But unfortunately, when you look at our media and you look at the images and the message as a whole, we always portray the female as the victim and the male as the victimizer. But we've actually seen situations in where the victimizer is the female and the victim is the male. So we definitely don't shed enough light on that. We definitely do not do enough to assist males who have been forced into prostitution or, again, are engaging in commercial sex acts in order to survive. And another thing that we're also seeing, again, is a lot of situations involving members of the LGBTQ community, specifically transgender youth and adults as well. Unfortunately, we see that there is a lot of discrimination against them. There is a lot of homophobia. And many of these people, unfortunately, are put in a situation where they don't necessarily receive the services that they are entitled to because they are transgender, or many of them may not be able to obtain jobs or keep jobs, you know, once people find out that they are transgender. So unfortunately, many of them have to resort to the commercial sex industry, again, in order to survive. But you just never see this being spoken of. It's almost like it's taboo. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing, unfortunately, is that we are pitting victim against victim. On top of that, you know, that's just within the sex trafficking movement or conversation. But when you look at human trafficking as a whole, you know, there are three types of trafficking.
Exactly.
But when you listen to the media, you watch these documentaries, you know, most people wouldn't even expect that there are other things that fall under that definition of human trafficking, such as domestic servitude and labor trafficking. And about 99% of the research, of the documentaries, of the books coming out, of articles that are being written, of the images, again, that are being displayed, you know, all over the internet, you know, 99% of it is all on sex trafficking of females. And you hardly see any information on victims of domestic servitude, the issue of labor trafficking, you know, what exactly is labor trafficking. And due to that, there's so many misconceptions. There's a lack of awareness, a lack of interest, actually. And what we're actually seeing, again, is we're pitting victim against victim. And we're actually receiving reports in where people are stating that due to the lack of resources that are being provided for forced labor, it's actually getting worse. So we're actually we're causing more harm than good at this point, which is very tragic.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, when you talk about labor trafficking, not just in the United States, but when you look globally, we are seeing children who are being kidnapped or being sold off by families or you know, simply finding themselves homeless or without families and being put into these situations. One in particular, there's this wonderful documentary, and I'll have you discuss a little bit about that, about the cocoa plantations in Africa. It's a fantastic documentary in which it depicts how our chocolate is made and who is really making our chocolate. So I was hoping maybe you can talk a little bit about that documentary and hopefully to kind of shed some light on how labor trafficking is very much connected to, you know, children being involved in this travesty.
Absolutely. One of the biggest things that people need to understand is that human trafficking as a whole is fueled by things such as globalization, poverty, unequal opportunities for women and girls, proliferation of organized criminal syndicates, of course, the demand for sexual exploitation and the demand for cheap labor definitely play a major part in this. But we only focus on the demand on sexual exploitation and not necessarily the demand for cheap labor or poverty or globalization. which is something that if you truly want to address the issue of human trafficking, you definitely have to look at those root causes. Because again, if we don't deal with those root causes, we're never going to make a dent in the issue. So going back to the demand, what we see is that every single one of us, whether we want to admit it or not, we are all feeling cheap labor. You know, we all depend on it, whether it's from the food that we eat, you know, the coffee or the tea that we drink, from the clothing that we wear, to the electronics that we use to communicate with each other on a daily basis. Unfortunately, all of those products have gone through the hands of victims of forced labor, you know, many of them children, majority of them are adults, but this is something that is very much close to us and most of us don't realize. The Department of Labor, or the U.S. Department of Labor, does research on 353 products that are imported into the United States every single year. And what they do is they break down that report into child labor, forced labor, both or none. And I can tell you every single product, all 353 of them, involves child labor. Most of them definitely uses, you know, forced labor. So again, when you're seeing the products that are being sold in our local grocery stores and stores, it's sad to know that we are basically paying for products that were made by child slaves, you know, adults who are being enslaved and exploited. But again, many of us may not realize that. Sometimes we do know that, but don't necessarily want to address the issue because, again, that's something that we depend on. And, you know, it's just unfortunate to see the total disregard when it comes to the issue of forced labor. We have shown the documentary that you mentioned. It's The Dark Side of Chocolate by Mickey Mizrahi and Robin Romano. And it explores the issue of child labor within the cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast of Africa. And it's interesting to see how much corruption there is within the cocoa industry. Again, to know that a lot of the various companies that, you know, we purchased chocolate from in 2001 signed the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which clearly states that they would not purchase cocoa from plantations that use children. And this is something that they signed in 2001. And to this day, they have yet to comply with anything and everything that they agreed with. So when you look at, you know, why are they not doing this? Well, honestly, you know, I almost don't blame them. You know, people are still purchasing chocolate. They're still making millions upon millions of dollars in profits. And as I mentioned before, most people either don't know what's going on, or if they do know, you know, for them it's not that big of a deal. You know, it's better to buy that Hershey bar or that Mars bar and enjoy that, you know, chocolate bar than really worry about children in other parts of the world. So it's just very tragic to see, again, the lack of disregard that we often see with many of these products, including cocoa.
Yeah, most certainly. And, you know, it's not even just the cocoa plantations, I'm sure. And, you know, I'm sure there are many experts out there who focus on, you know, particular countries and particular nations where we do see child labor, and it's with whichever industry. But you're correct. Many times there are people who will forego the thought of the fact that, you know, their dress that they're purchasing was made probably by, you know, a very poor 15-year-old who has to make money to support their family, but really they're not making anything at all, or maybe making pennies, if anything, and working under harsh conditions. And it's something that is a global problem. So, Giselle, you know, one thing that I really wanted to
because we began speaking about this, I really wanted to look at these myths and misconceptions that are out there when we are talking about what human trafficking looks like and the way that people perceive it. And unfortunately, we live in a world where media and just certain organizations and certain people will glorify and exploit the idea of sex trafficking, and, you know, as you mentioned, where people come from a very good place, a lot of times it navigates itself to an area where it becomes more self-fulfilling than anything else. But I did want to, you know, here in the U.S., we have a big topic of illegal immigration or migrant workers, and I'm sure we do see this in other parts of the Americas, in South America, Central America, go to Asia, anywhere really, where migrant workers become a problem. And a lot of times people misunderstand what that migrant worker, why they're here and what brought them here and the way that they operate and who they operate under. So I was hoping you can maybe kind of help us debunk a little bit about these ideas that people create about what labor trafficking and migrant work looks like.
Absolutely. Well, definitely we do see that international victims that are brought into the U.S. Are coming here for a better life. They're coming here for an opportunity. I mean, we do a very good job of portraying ourselves as the land of opportunity, you know, the land of milk and honey. Everyone wants to live the American dream. So many of these people are looking for that, which makes it easier for traffickers to lure them with these false promises. You know, one thing that people need to understand is that victims of human trafficking are not stupid or uneducated. They're just very hopeful and goal-oriented people who really want the best for not only themselves, but their families. A lot of people do believe that all of the victims that are brought into the country are coming in through our borders, but we actually see that that isn't necessarily true. Prior to 2000, absolutely, the victims that were being found, the majority of them had been smuggled into the United States, mainly from the Mexican border. However, since 2007, when the guest worker visa program was initiated by our country, we've actually seen that a lot of the survivors that have been found within the U.S. actually arrive through our airports with some type of visa, whether it's a fiancé visa, an education visa, or J-1. We've seen visas that are provided to athletes or entertainers. The more popular one that we've seen use are either the tourist or what's called, again, the guest worker visa, which is the H-2A, which is given to skilled labor, or the H-2B, which is given to unskilled labor. And the whole premise of that program was brought on due to the fact that our government felt as though there were jobs that our own citizens, that Americans just didn't want to do. And there were plenty of people who were willing and able to perform these jobs. So we created a temporary visa that lasts anywhere between 6 to 9 months, that allows foreign-born workers to come into the U.S., work, and then be able to return to their home country. Now, the staffing agencies are the ones who basically apply for these visas, and they provide the housing and the transportation to the workers. They basically take care of all their needs. They are the ones who contract with the companies within the U.S. and are the ones who oftentimes receive the money that is supposed to be given to the workers. The catch is, no matter what happens to the workers, whether they're abused or not, if they run away, they then become a criminal and they could be arrested and then more than likely deported. So it gives these staffing agencies a lot of power. What we've seen, unfortunately, is traffickers are now infiltrating the system and they're applying for LLCs and now they're, you know, the heads of businesses or companies. And all the members of the ring are also, you know, the secretary, the vice president, the treasurer. So we're actually seeing more and more of these types of situations and where the victims did come, you know, using that system instead of coming in through the borders. Now, as far as the foreign-born workers, we have actually seen them in the agricultural industry, again, with that H-2B visa. And we've also seen them in industries within the hospitality industry, so in like country clubs, restaurants, hotels. We've also seen victims in nail salons or hair salons. We've seen some where they were working in assisted living facilities and may not necessarily have had the training to work in that type of industry. On the other side, as I mentioned, the H-2A, there are cases that have been found in the U.S. involving nurses or school teachers, mainly from the Philippines. So we've definitely seen a shift where it's not so much illegal immigration that is involved with a lot of the human trafficking cases found in the U.S. What we're seeing is more legal entry. And again, these are our men and women who were brought here under the pretense of the opportunity to work in either the hospitality or some type of, you know, industry. And unfortunately, none of those things truly happened. So it's interesting to see how things have changed. And go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, absolutely. And you know, I the word on the street is, or word in the media, rather, when we look at someone like Trump now being exposed in the past using illegal immigrants and illegal workers and failing to pay them, you know, that's something that is now coming up. So it's interesting to see how even in the political arena these types of things are being exposed, but no one's really throwing out the word trafficking yet.
No, absolutely. And that's definitely one thing that is concerning, because there's, you know, time and time again, there's all these reports in where workers that have, you know, been involved in building Trump's buildings or even the country club that is here in the state of Florida, time and time again, there are reports that show that many of those workers are illegal immigrants that possibly could be exploited. You know, the media doesn't dig too deep into what's going on, but it definitely makes you wonder what is going on. And it's somewhat sad because here human trafficking has become such a hot topic within the United States. But there's actually only been one candidate who's even mentioned this issue, and it's you would think that this would garner some type of attention, but even when this one candidate mentioned it, the media didn't even pick up on what he was saying. So it was disheartening to see, you know, such a great moment to see a presidential candidate actually mention some of the issues that are going on, specifically with forced labor, and no one really addressing it or talking about it. So it's been a very different presidential theme or
yeah.
Theme. So it's,
right.
It's again, when it comes to the issue of human trafficking and the political, revolution that we're seeing, it's a little worrisome.
Right. And, you know, even touching on the idea of the political arena, so to speak, you know, domestic servitude is so oftentimes looked over, and diplomats are definitely guilty of participating in that. And that's not necessarily, and, you know, let me be clear, I'm not saying all diplomats, but unfortunately there are those people who do carry a lot of power who are coming from their native countries with their workers, their staff, so to speak. And what you know, a lot of people aren't really looking at is, are we seeing domestic servitude in these situations? And I'm hoping maybe you can touch a little on that as well.
Absolutely. Domestic servitude is such a frustrating situation because, first and foremost, they're very difficult to find. The cases that have been prosecuted within the United States, when you look at how the case was found, sometimes you have to wonder, you know, how was there a divine intervention that occurred? Something always happened out of the ordinary. Sometimes the traffickers made a mistake, but something that typically didn't happen in a household occurred. And because of that, that caused some type of attention to be paid on the victim. So really interesting to again, see how these cases were actually found. But victims of domestic servitude truly are invisible because they are kept in homes. They're not allowed to go outside. Most people that, you know, have gone into these homes where there were victims of domestic servitude didn't even realize that, you know, these women and or girls were even in the home. And one of the things is that absolutely there have been cases of domestic servitude where it was just regular people, but there's also been domestic servitude cases, you know, found within the U.S. and where the trafficker or exploiter was a diplomat. And due to the fact that they do receive immunity, it's very tough to sit and watch, you know, what's going on. You know, our organization has been involved in a case where a diplomat came to the Orlando area to enjoy, you know, the theme parks in that region of Florida, and was him and his wife were abusing three Filipino women. It was horrible what was being done to these women. And luckily, someone at the hotel where they were staying at recognized something and called, you know, for help. We were able to assist these three women, but, you know, again, as soon as law enforcement got involved and found out that they were diplomats, it was like, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do about this. But at least, you know, the most important part for us is that those three women were able to get out of that harmful situation, and they were able to receive services until they decided to go back to their home country. But this is something that we definitely see a lot. And one of the biggest issues that most people may not realize is that the type of visa that is provided to the servants coming in with the diplomats, there's really no record of them at the State Department. So it's very hard for anyone to do any type of follow-up on these women that, again, are being brought in by diplomats. So to me, it was shocking to find out that, you know, again, the State Department absolutely kept no records on a lot of these servants that were being brought to our country.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, we are going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to be continuing with questions with Giselle Rodriguez from the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org. to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back. Thank you. Again, if you're just joining us today, we are here with Giselle Rodriguez, the State Outreach Coordinator for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking and the founder of the Tampa Bay Rescue and Restore Coalition. So we're definitely talking a lot about the idea of what human trafficking is, what it looks like, what are some of the myths and misconceptions. And we've been talking a lot about the United States and the rules and regulations that apply here. Giselle, something I really kind of wanted to bring to your attention, since you do have exposure to
what's been going on in other countries. Do you notice a difference with trafficking in the United States versus trafficking in other parts of the world? And with that, what I mean to say is not just how they're being trafficked, but how is trafficking really being combated?
Absolutely. One of the things that I have gotten the chance to do is not only go to other countries and not only educate others, but of course I'm also getting educated on what they're seeing. But I've also had the privilege of working with anti-trafficking advocates who are invited by the State Department to come to the U.S. And meet with other anti-trafficking advocates and law enforcement in order to almost compare notes on, you know, what are you seeing in your country and what are you doing or how did you address this particular form of trafficking? So we've definitely met with people from countries such as Thailand, India, China. Recently, I had the honor of meeting with advocates from Iraq and Switzerland and Argentina. I mean, it's the list is endless. And of course, you know, we talk to them about, you know, what's happening here within the U.S. and specifically Florida. And one thing that I always hear, the comments that we always hear is, well, why are you guys not doing enough to address labor trafficking? Why is it that you only focus on sex trafficking? You know, at the last meeting that we had, it was hard to hear our law enforcement state, well, you know, we just don't get the resources that we need. Some of us haven't been fully trained on forced labor. It was shocking for our visitors to hear that. And it's definitely something that, again, with every single visit, a lot of them are shocked to learn the fact that, you know, our country just isn't doing enough to address forced labor. One of the things that they do talk about is that, yes, you know, they do address sex trafficking, but of course, their biggest problems in all the countries that, again, the members are coming from, you know, their biggest issue that they're tackling is labor trafficking. And they do talk about some of the things that they're doing in order to help combat it. But one of the issues that they also face is, again, due to the fact that there's such high demand for cheap labor within our country, and the fact that we just don't really address it doesn't necessarily assist them either. So they're also looking at us like, well, what are you guys going to do? You know, how are you going to help us in ending the issue of forced labor? So it's very interesting to see their perspective. And of course, when they start questioning us on the lack of efforts that we are putting forward towards forced labor, it's a little embarrassing, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I find interesting is that, you know, and people, when they ask about, you know, trafficking here and how we have laws that are created and how we kind of do the prosecutions and whatnot, when you look at other nations, one I'm just going to throw out there, Saudi Arabia, they really don't have any laws or anything that really stops anyone from using and abusing another human being. In fact, I think it's just culturally, I guess, for some individuals, acceptable to partake in these abuses.
Absolutely. We've definitely seen, and I've actually been in a couple of countries in where cultural beliefs really plays a big part in the exploitation of so many. And it's disheartening to see how a lot of these cultural beliefs and lack of awareness and lack of proper laws really makes it hard for victims of trafficking to be noticed, to be assisted, and for the traffickers to be apprehended and prosecuted. So that's definitely an issue that you hear time and time again. And again, no country's perfect, but there are some that, again, the lack of interest in this subject really is very worrisome.
Right. And it, with your organizations that you work with, what are some skill sets or some ideas that you both can exchange with one another to try to create more progressive steps or progressive legislation, not just here, but...
Well, some of the things that we definitely do in these meetings is just talk about, you know, what's actually worked. What are some of the things that you have seen that have actually been successful? What are some of the things that you have done that weren't necessarily so successful? And what we try to do is learn from each other's mistakes and try to learn from each other's victories. Even if they're small victories, it's still something that will definitely help. So it's you know, these visits that the State Department puts, you know, hosts really makes a difference, because it's nice to, often hear about different tactics that different countries are using in order to address the issue of human trafficking, prevention, awareness. It really gives you so many different ideas. And I can tell you, when I walk out of those meetings, I'm like, wow, you know, maybe this is something we should try. Unfortunately, sometimes these ideas tend to be a little bit more progressive than what we're used to. So sometimes when I mention these ideas, people just kind of look at me like, wait a second, I'm not sure that's going to work. But it still is interesting, because, again, it really does give you a different perspective and ideas on how to better provide services to victims that are being found within our country.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think keeping that open dialogue is going to be a really positive step for people, and having realistic conversations, not just fluff and stuff.
Absolutely.
Basil, I'm just wondering, do we have any callers that are curious to ask Giselle any questions, or perhaps give their input in our discussion today?
Yeah, we have one or two people here who want to ask Giselle a few questions, but we're going to be taking some of those questions as soon as we return from a short break.
Sure.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, and our guest, our esteemed guest, Giselle. We have one person who wants to ask an important question to our guest, Giselle. I want to turn it to Ryan Jacobs. Ryan, I want to bring you on the air. You can ask your question now.
Thank you, Basil, and thank you, Jacqueline, and thank you for your time, Giselle. I have an important question for you. I'm curious of your thoughts in regards to international tobacco companies such as Marlboro and child labor laws, especially how poverty provokes exploitation, how promoting rural development can exist in eradicating such abuses upon children.
Absolutely. You know, as I mentioned before, that is definitely one of the root causes. And unfortunately, we just don't see too many advocates or too many groups or laws that really address those root causes for any form of human trafficking. And again, as I mentioned before, globalization plays a big part in this. Poverty plays a major part in this. In regards to the tobacco industry, absolutely, we do see that there is a lot of child labor involved in these industries. Now, recently, I want to say towards the end of last year, the New York Times did a piece on child labor in the tobacco fields of North Carolina. And their piece was fantastic. It was very riveting. It showed these pictures of small children. And one of the things that they did was they actually talked to medical experts that talked about the dangers of children handling the tobacco, especially with the fact that these children were found not to have any type of protective gear to handle the tobacco. And what the medical experts talked about, again, is just how dangerous it is for these children. And they actually said it was even more dangerous than smoking, you know, 18 cigarettes, you know, per day. Once this article came up, there was some discussion in Congress, the U.S. Congress. However, especially now with some of the things that have happened with Justice Anthony Scalia passing away and of course, some of the things that are going with the presidential election, we've seen that conversation has died down. So this is something that we definitely need people to assist, is contacting their representatives and asking them to start that conversation again and put something together that will actually help make a difference. But again, this started being addressed and it little by little died down. So unfortunately, I haven't seen anything that will really fully address this situation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. That's something that when we look at legislation, it becomes problematic to try to create resolutions if the legislation is not fully behind and being enforced. We will definitely take the question from the next caller in one moment, but something I wanted to ask you, since we're on this topic, people are oftentimes outraged at why people aren't being arrested, why isn't anything being done, and prosecuting human trafficking is a very difficult concept. So I was hoping that you can kind of explain to our viewers a little bit about what that looks like when you have someone who is being prosecuted as a trafficker and the difficulties that go into sentencing.
Sure. Well, one of the things that people may not realize is, first of all, how complex it is to actually prove human trafficking. There are certain elements that have to be shown. You have to be able to show that either force or fraud or coercion were used to induce either the Commercial Sex Act or that forced labor type situation, that job that was required of them to do. On top of that, you have to be able to show or link up the three stages, which is the means, the hows, and the purpose. So you have to be able to show, you know, what was done to this person. How did this happen? You know, how did they end up in the situation? Were they sold? Were they kidnapped? Were they seduced with a false promise? You know, how did they get in that position? And, of course, you have to be able to show the purpose of this. You know, was it for, again, the commercial sex industry or for some type of forced labor operation? On top of that, what people need to understand, too, is that sometimes these cases have large amounts of victims. The largest case that we dealt with had 50 victims. Well, now you have to interview 50 different people. You have to get 50 different stories. You have to get evidence for the 50 people. If they're coming from a different country, you know, part of that crime scene is their home country. So you have to send agents to their home country to do part of the investigation there. And anywhere that victim was taken to, that's an additional crime scene that you have to look into. So the investigation portion of it can be very lengthy. And one of the things that the investigators do a good job of is they try to find as much evidence to corroborate what the victims are reporting, because they want to try and take as much pressure off of the victim from having to testify and having to go up against a defense attorney. So they want to make sure that their cases are as ironclad as possible. And it's worked. I mean, oftentimes a lot of these trafficking cases that actually make it into the court system, you see that a lot of the times the traffickers plea out because there's so much evidence against them. So these cases, when you're working on them, you're definitely involved for the long haul. That case that I mentioned with the 50 victims that were found at one time, you know, it took about 2 years before the Department of Homeland Security was able to make an indictment. But by the time the arrest happened, that was in April, and the sentencing occurred in December because, again, once the defense attorneys saw all the evidence that Department of Homeland Security had put together, the defense attorneys were like, listen, there's really nothing you can do to fight this one. So it's good to see that, yes, you know, once the arrest is made and the indictment happens, that these cases do move forward. But that's due to the due diligence that a lot of these investigators are putting forward on these intense cases.
Right. And just to add to this, while there is a criminal case going on, there are benefits for survivors through a federal means of like a victim's compensation of sorts. And very importantly, and hopefully you can kind of touch a little bit upon this, that while the criminal investigation is going on, it is important that federal lawyers are able to assist in helping to get restitution for many of these survivors.
Absolutely. But and that's one of the things. Under the TVPA, there is the Victim's Bill of Rights. And one of the things that is actually listed as a right to any victim of human trafficking, whether they're foreign-born or born within the U.S., but they have the right to restitution. Unfortunately, what we are seeing is that a lot of these restitution-type cases aren't actually being filed. And recently there was a civil attorney by the name of Martina Vernberg, from Florida, actually, who has brought that to the attention and is actually saying that, you know, we're failing victims because we aren't getting that restitution for them. So I have to admit, you know, when I started working on some of these cases in the earlier years, I was seeing that these restitution cases were occurring. In the last couple of years, I want to say 2-3 years, I have not seen that. So that's definitely a concern, and I'm glad that there are civil attorneys who are speaking up and out against this situation, because this is very serious.
Absolutely. Basil, I know we have one caller on the line who does have a question.
Yeah, the caller just dropped. But again, I want to ask my personal question to our esteemed guest, Giselle, who's been talking graciously about some of the issues that we face in our world today that honestly have been really ignored, not only by the mainstream media, but also by people who are in a position of authority. And she's been talking about child trafficking or human trafficking. And most especially, Giselle, you've really talked about child exploitation, the benefit fraud using such terms as forced marriage, domestic servitude, or such as cleaning and all kinds of all forms of domestic servitude. You've also talked about forced labor, which is honestly one of the factors that need to be considered when you were making reference to the issues of forced labor that is experienced in some countries in Africa. And then you also highlighted the criminal aspect of the of trafficking. I want to really bring you to back to the international scene. I happen to have discussed child trafficking, human trafficking with Carole Bellamy. Carole Bellamy was the executive director of UNICEF between, I think she left the office in 2005. And last year, 2014, we had a conversation in our organization here about human trafficking right here in New York, where she was really highlighting some of the activities or the efforts, organizations, international organizations such as UNICEF and some other organizations like International Labor Organization have really what they have done as a response to some of the issues that you have raised. And one of the things that they did, honestly, was to form what the United Nations refers to as the United Nations Global Initiative to Fight Human Trafficking. This was a coalition arrangement between the International Labor Organization and also UNICEF through Carole Bellamy and many others played a very important role in 2007 in launching this effort. I want to ask you, Giselle, given the efforts that the international community have really made, why do we still experience an increase in human trafficking? Why do we still experience an increase in child trafficking globally?
I think it's because, again, and this is my opinion, but I really feel that because we are not addressing causes. And we're not fully addressing the demand for forced labor. As I mentioned before, you know, there are so many products that are imported into the U.S., you know, 353 to be exact, that are imported into the U.S. That involve child labor. And this is something that, you know, we accept. Many of us purchase, you know, without any issues. And because of that, you know, again, These products are coming from other countries that are trying to address the issues of forced labor or forced prostitution. But because we as consumers in the U.S. aren't necessarily doing our part, I don't think that allows other countries and the coalition that you mentioned, I just don't feel that we are supporting them enough to fully fulfill what it is that they need to or want to be able to accomplish in order to make a dent on the issue of child labor. And believe me, I go into the local community within Florida, and I mention this, and people, their response is like, well, I really don't want to have to pay $20 for, you know, a cheeseburger now because of this, or, well, you know, at least we're getting paid. You know, some of the attitudes that I see and some of the responses that I hear, it's just, again, it's very disheartening. And I don't think that, again, we as consumers are doing enough to really assist a lot of these countries or really help these plans that have been put together to do what they were meant to do. So that's how I see it. I know a lot of people would disagree with that. We are just not doing enough to address the root causes, specifically demand.
And right. Just a follow-up to that question, Giselle, and you talked about different indicators of human trafficking. And I just want to ask you, if the victim, for instance, one of the indicators, as you were talking about, has to do with the fact that the victim is forced to perform actions. One of them are certain acts, and one of them is sexual acts. And that aspect, honestly, in this very conversation, I know we want to look at the misconceptions of involved in human trafficking, but the aspect of sexual acts, I think they are so very important. I heard you say that the media, honestly, is not giving us the real, the exact, portraying the exact situation with respect to what's going on. And that, I think, is one thing that has to be addressed domestically. And that I want to really bring our attention to the role of social media and, again, the internet. What do you think are the contributions of this age, the technological age that we live in? What do you think are the contributions that the technological advancement or advancement in technology and all that have contributed in the growth or rate of human and sexual trafficking and all that?
I think that the social media aspect is a good and a bad thing. It's definitely a catch-22. As I mentioned before, unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. So in the United States, there have been numerous websites and numerous groups that have stated that anywhere between 100,000 to 300,000 children are either at risk or are being prostituted out on the streets of America every year. Recently, it was found out that that number was part of a research that took place in 2001. And the researchers basically stated that there are 14 risk factors that make children more at risk of being commercially sexually exploited. Now, if one child met five of those risk factors, they were counted five times. If they met all 14, they were counted 14 times, which means that 100 to 300,000 number is inflated. If you go on social media and you start looking at what we call either commercial sexual exploitation of children or domestic minor sex trafficking, there are so many people who have retweeted, you know, pictures and graphics and memes with that specific number that says, you know, 100 to 300,000 children, or sometimes they'll say 300,000 children are being forced into prostitution every day. So we're now sharing false information over and over and over and over again, which is bad. And unfortunately, we're starting to see that a lot of our laws are being based on the number that we know is inflated. And that doesn't really help. So that's the bad thing. The good thing is when there actually is good information out there, again, we can share that with numerous people at the same time at a fast rate. So as I mentioned before, there's good things about it, but there's also a lot of bad about it. And until everyone understands, first and foremost, we truly have no idea how many people are enslaved. You know, the ILO has a number. There's another group that came out with a number, the Global Slavery Index, which I know has also been under attack due to the methodology that they used. But the thing is, we don't know for sure how many victims exist globally, let alone how many victims exist in the U.S. But again, we're putting out these numbers. You know, every 26 seconds, another slave is sold. Every minute this happens, when we still don't know how many people are truly victims of this heinous crime. So that's why I'm a little hesitant to praise social media in helping us when I see so much embellished information being reshared and reposted and retweeted.
Right, Giselle. And, you know, I think also, you know, to touch on Basil's question, it's also become easier for traffickers to identify potential victims based on, again, and again, this speaks a lot, too, to where you talk about this root problem. When you have young people who are on the Internet, ready to understand, like ready to share all their information to whomever wants to in order to gain followers, to become popular on the internet. And really it becomes a game of catfish where we don't know who is really behind the other side. So,
Absolutely.
You know, when you do look at that. Yeah. And you look at those and you see traffickers using those outlets, how does that increase? And really, again, how do we speak to the root problem of that with parenting and understanding how technology works?
Absolutely. You know, the internet really feels so many good things, but also feels a lot of bad things. And one of the things is that our younger population, our millennials, have grown up knowing what the internet was. They use it for so many different reasons, and there's so many different social media outlets, and some of them feel more comfortable sharing things through social media than they do with someone who's face to face with them. What many of them don't understand is that there's a lot of information that they're putting out there that not just traffickers, but people who have not so good intent, you know, criminals are out there. And unfortunately, they're making it easy for many of these exploiters to know or learn about them, know where they're going. And it makes it very easy for, again, the exploiters to reach out to our youth and start a, you know, quote unquote relationship, a bond, a friendship. And unfortunately, we have seen cases in the U.S. where traffickers were very bold and immediately started this conversation, and little by little, they really started building rapport with the person, ultimately to the point where they ended up meeting, and then, of course, some awful things happened to them. We've also seen some cases. There was one case prosecuted out of Chicago in where the trafficker was very blunt and was basically asking, you know, teenage girls, hey, do you want to make quick money? Do you want to make a lot of money? And it was interesting to see how many of them responded immediately, not knowing who this person was, basically saying, sure, I'd like to learn how to make money. So there really wasn't a whole lot of seduction or coercion or abuse. It was very straightforward of, do you want to make money? And this is how you're going to make it. And to see just how many of them agreed to that, it definitely makes you look at social media a little bit differently than most people do. So it's not just the spreading of the misinformation, but just the fact that it makes so much or so many of our youth so vulnerable to being recruited. And as far as awareness, you know, I just think more and more parents need to understand all the different media outlets that are out there that their kids can get into, and really have a good, solid conversation with them about, you know, what it is that they're putting out there. You know, they put pictures out there that they don't realize may have an impact in the future. So it's really about, you know, again, education and really talking to the youth and getting them to see how dangerous some of the choices they're making online really are.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, going further, when we even look at the international community, you know, you have false advertisements promising, you know, this agency will bring you to America and you will work as a waitress or a resort and make money to send home to your family. And obviously people have hopes and dreams of saying, yes, I'd love to. And not even just in the United States, but, you know, if you are living in, you know, I'm trying to come up with just an example. Someone lives in another country and is promised to come to France and during the tourist season work at this restaurant and make money, and you have these false travel agencies who are creating false representation, and the internet makes it easy for people to get this information.
Absolutely. And you know, that whole cliche of, you know, if it sounds too good to be good, I can't even say right now, too good to be true. People need to start listening to that. They really need to stop and think, okay, what's being offered to me? You know, here I am in the Philippines and I'm being offered a job in Dubai doing this. Like, wow, this just sounds too amazing. Well, if it sounds too amazing, maybe it isn't true. Maybe you should really step back and look at something else. But again, I think we have just become too trusting. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think people really need to just, again, the time to look at everything. And if you feel like something's not right, they really need to listen to their gut and not move forward. And that's something that I've heard a lot from the clients I've worked with from other countries. They just kept saying, you know, my family just said something didn't sound right, that it was just too perfect of an opportunity, that I should have listened. And that's really something that, especially the youth, again, we could do is listen to the adults. I know we want to believe that we're invincible and we know everything, but sometimes it's really good to listen to what our elders are trying to tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. So Giselle and Basil, we're going to take a quick short break, and when we come back, we will kind of finalize everything and talk about some hopes for the future. Welcome back. We are here with Giselle Rodriguez, the State Outreach Coordinator for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking and founder of the Tampa Bay Rescue and Restore Organization. So, Giselle, as we wrap up all of today's conversation, and there is so much knowledge that you brought forth to the table here, I just want to take your expert opinion and really ask you from your heart, what are some of these changes that you would really like to see happen, not just on a legislative level, but also looking at cultural and social levels, in order to assist, help, and aid survivors of all forms of trafficking?
I really think the only way we're going to truly make a difference, and I know I must sound like a broken record, but I just can't say this enough, is really understanding what all of the root causes are, not just the demand aspect, because if you look specifically in the U.S., all of the laws that are being written at the moment tend to focus on the demand for sexual exploitation, not necessarily demand for forced labor, but sexual exploitation. The thing is, what many of us don't understand is that by just focusing on that aspect alone, we're still not looking into what made some of these women, men, children vulnerable in the first place. Why did they end up in a situation where it was so easy for them to be recruited by a trafficker? And again, it goes back to issues such as poverty, homelessness, unequal opportunities for women and girls, the lack of education, of course, the proliferation of organized crime, globalization. In order to truly address this issue, we have to look at all of the root causes and find out what we can do to address demand, but how can we also address the supply? What can we do to empower them? What can we do to ensure that they're not impoverished or that they're not homeless, and what can we do to ensure that they are receiving an education that will benefit not only them but their families, help them achieve those goals, and again, not place them in a situation where they're vulnerable and desperate in order to obtain the bare necessities. And you know, I think once we actually do that, we'll actually start seeing a difference, not just here in the U.S., but globally, really.
As I mentioned before, the ILO has done an amazing job working with other international groups on putting together policies, but I just feel like they're not being addressed. You know, not that many people even realize that's, you know, those resources are out there. And I really think that we need to do a better job of looking into that. And again, truly understanding all of the root causes of human trafficking.
Absolutely. Thank you, Giselle. And we have one more caller who would like to ask you a question. Tamara from New York, please ask your question.
Hello. My question is, do you feel international law has been increasingly beneficial in thwarting human traffickers overall regarding all forms of slavery?
Depends on what country. I have to say there have been some countries that have done an amazing job of putting together laws that really address the issue from every aspect and have done an amazing job of making a dent to the point where they're not seeing as many trafficking cases as they used to. They're actually reporting a decrease. Unfortunately, many of these countries aren't provided or being given enough credit. They're not in the spotlight. So many people don't even realize some of the great work that countries like Ecuador have done to address human trafficking. Now, there are some countries that do not necessarily have a law, aren't necessarily adhering to the Palermo Protocol, and aren't really doing a whole lot to address it because, unfortunately, they also are benefiting from these trafficking schemes that are happening within their country. So it really depends, again, on what aspect you're talking about, what countries you're talking about specifically. I do think that the Palermo Protocol is an amazing law, and it's wonderful to see so many countries duplicating that law. Although the U.S. ratified the Palermo and did put together a federal law, it's still a little disheartening to see that some of the things that were written in the Palermo Protocol, such as organ harvesting, child soldiers, and illegal adoptions, are not addressed in our federal law. So that would be something that I think would be very beneficial for the U.S. to eventually add to their anti-human trafficking law.
Wonderful. Thank you, Samara, for your question. And
thank
finally,
you for answering.
And finally, Giselle, you know, you've provided us with so much information. What are ways, I know a lot of people want to know, what are ways that they can get involved in their own communities, and how can people find out more about what the Florida Coalition is doing?
Sure. This is something I'm asked every time I go out into the community. And some of the answers, I have to tell you, people are really surprised because they're thinking, wow, it's so simple. I didn't think it was going to be this simple. But some of the things I always tell people in regards to the issue of forced labor, I really do promote fair trade products. Most people don't understand the whole concept of fair trade, but by purchasing fair trade products, you're ensuring that the workers behind the making of that product are, first of all, not children, are not being abused, are actually being paid fair wages, and are being treated, and the working conditions are humane. By purchasing fair trade products, we are definitely taking a stance against organizations that are benefiting from forced labor. And that really makes a difference, again, in the fight against specifically labor trafficking. So just changing your habits as a consumer can really make a difference. Some of the other things, again, is just talking about it. As I mentioned before, there's still a lot of denial that this crime even exists. We've all been taught that, you know, slavery was abolished, you know, over 150 years ago, but that is far from the truth. And I think the more we talk about it, the more people become educated, the more they start speaking out against it and really putting pressure on their representatives. I think that is going to really make a difference. So, again, on a personal note, changing your habits as a consumer, and then in regards to issues happening within the community, really just speaking out and again, putting some pressure on the representatives to take this issue seriously and become more involved themselves. And as far as people wanting to keep up with the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, of course, they can visit our website, which is www.stophumantrafficking.org. On that page, you can see that you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, and you can also connect with us through social media. We do have a Facebook page as well as a Twitter handle, which is at Free All Slaves. But again, all that information is on our website, which is www.stophumantrafficking.org.
Fantastic. And Giselle, if you don't mind, we have one more caller who would really love to ask you this question. This is Kristen from New York. Kristen, go ahead, ask your question.
Hi. Hi, Jackie. Hi, Giselle. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
What an amazing conversation. I'm just so impressed by the work you're doing. This is a big, big mountain to climb, so keep up the great work. I'm curious, talking about cultural norms and talking about young people and how easy it is, especially in the U.S., people get lured to be interested in what's going out there, to just start conversations with, you know, men or people on the internet that they don't know, and how some of these perpetrators can be so bold, right? And it's really not a deceiving kind of thing, but alluring, you know, maybe an ignorance kind of thing or a youth kind of thing. I wonder if, and this might be a hot topic, but you said, you know, in terms of addressing the supply, are there ways to get or have organizations try to maybe get youth to talk to youth about, you know, hey, I thought I was really smart. I thought I was able to kind of go out on my own. I realized it was better to take mom's advice. You know, because especially youth in the U.S. nowadays don't want to take that older person's advice. So I'm curious if that's an opportunity to maybe bridge some of those conversations and get young kids to sort of pay attention to some of these activities that they're participating in.
Absolutely. We have definitely seen that approach occur within the U.S. And, you know, it's hit or miss. You know, for some youth, they'll pay attention and listen and say, wow, you know, that's terrible, and thank you for sharing that. And there have been a couple who are like, oh, whatever, that's because she's stupid, you know. Depending on that child's upbringing, you know, you're going to get different results from those types of conversations. But that's something that we definitely do. You know, we definitely talk to teens who may be at risk, who may be in and out of the criminal justice or dependency system. We also talk to kids, you know, at the school level. And one of the things that we try to do is just help them understand the reality of the commercial sex industry. If you turn on our TV and watch some of the reality shows or listen to some of the music, you know, unfortunately, a lot of it tends to glamorize certain things or certain crimes that are occurring in our country. And they may not understand the reality. They may not understand how seedy and how dangerous the commercial sex industry may be. And once you start peeling back, you know, the various levels and you start exposing the reality of what truly happens, you know, they start looking things at, you know, or they start looking at things a little bit differently. Another challenge that we see in talking to the youth, again, is I went back to their upbringing, you know, the environment that they're in. You know, we have spoken to kids whose parents may be involved in the commercial sex industry or a relative may be involved
in the commercial sex industry. So, of course, for them, this is very normal. So how do you think they're going to take a strange woman basically saying, well, this is really bad, when someone that they're very close to may actually be engaging in that same type of behavior? And we've heard, recently we had one girl basically say, well, you know, my mom taught me that, you know, and I apologize for being vulgar, but I was just repeating it how it was told to me. But this young girl said, you know, my mom taught me that closed legs don't get fed. So when you're coming from that type of environment, trying to educate them again on the reality of how dangerous this could be can be challenging at times. So there's definitely different approaches that you have to take. You have to be prepared for anything. And again, it's always good to have another person who may have gone through something similar to talk to them. But if that doesn't work, then again, you're going to have to go into your bag of tricks and figure out different ways to get the message across to them.
Wow. Thank you. That's such a great perspective. I really appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back. So this was an amazing opportunity to talk with Giselle about such an important topic, and something that many people on a very superficial level have been discussing over and over again, but it was very refreshing to kind of get more of a deeper perspective and really flesh out and get into more about the different levels of human trafficking. So with this, I would like to end the show, and I would like to thank our guest, Giselle Rodriguez, the Outreach Coordinator for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking and founder of the Tampa Bay Rescue and Restore Coalition. Giselle, thank you so much for all the great work that you and Anna do. And I know that, you know, this is still going on in so many different parts of the world, and your organization and your connections with all organizations around the world have really been doing a phenomenal job. And we want to thank you mostly for coming on today and sharing your wealth of knowledge with us and with our listeners. So, again, thank you so much, Giselle.
No, thank you for the opportunity, and it was wonderful speaking with not only you but the callers about some of the things that are taking place. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. And again, we hope to have you again for another episode of ICERM Radio. So thank you again for coming. And thanks to you, our listeners, and our supporters. Remember, you can always come back to listen to this show. It's on our website, www.icermmediation.org.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ICERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be hard. Like early 90s heavy metal hard.
I'm yelling and screaming and I'm loud. Roar!
Geico makes it easy. You can review and update your policy or report a claim on Geico.com or the Geico mobile app. Because shouldn't we all have a little less stress in our lives?
I'm not even upset about anything.